Вариант 16.
Сейчас вы будете выполнять задание по аудированию. Каждый текст прозвучит два раза. После первого и второго прослушивания у вас будет время для выполнения и проверки заданий. Все паузы включены в аудиозапись. Остановка и повторное воспроизведение аудиозаписи не предусмотрены. По окончании выполнения всего раздела «Аудирование» перенесите свои ответы в бланк ответов номер один. Задание 1. Вы услышите 6 высказываний. Установите соответствие между высказываниями каждого говорящего «AF» и утверждениями, данными в списке 1-7. Используйте каждое утверждение, обозначенное соответствующей цифрой, только один раз. В задании есть одно лишнее утверждение. Вы услышите запись дважды. Занесите свои ответы в таблицу. У вас есть 20 секунд, чтобы ознакомиться с заданием.
Now we are ready to start. Speaker A.
My absolute favorite film of all time is Local Hero. Peter Riggert plays a Texas oil man who's sent to a stunningly picturesque Scottish fishing town to negotiate with the locals to buy the whole town so that his company can raise it to build an enormous oil refinery. This film, while being warm and hilarious, is also one of the most subtle films I've ever seen. The humor of some of the scenes can slip by if you're not paying attention. In fact, I picked up more and of its subtleties with each subsequent viewing.
Speaker B.
Manhattan is a film that could make a boy like me, who's never been to New York, fall in love with the place. Funny, bittersweet, sad, pulsing to the great tunes of George Gershwin, and shot in stunningly gorgeous widescreen black and white by Gordon Willis. And I almost always cry at the ending. I think this is Woody Allen's greatest film, despite the fact that Annie Hall won more accolades from Hollywood. It's far more sophisticated, more bittersweet, still bitingly funny, but more of a ride for your emotions. A masterpiece.
Speaker C.
Mere words fail to describe this film. You've heard of it. It's A Space Odyssey. See it if you haven't, and prepare to have your mind blown. It is a film that sort of encompasses art as a whole rather than just utilizing the cinema. It is a movie, it is a painting, it is a philosophy book, and finally a musical symphony. Do not watch it on video, or you'll miss 2/3 of the images. Douglas Trumbull and the people who brought Arthur C. Clarke and Stanley Kubrick's vision to the screen set a standard of visual effects that's still hard to beat, in my opinion.
Speaker D.
My favourite film, The Jetty, is in black and white. It's in French, it's only 30 minutes long, and except for one briefly moving image, it's told entirely in still images. After the destruction of Paris in World War III, a man obsessed by an image from his childhood is sent by the rulers of the survivors as an emissary to the past, in search of food and medicine, precisely because this image seems to be the only thing keeping the journey through time from failing. There, he falls in love. It's one of the most amazing, brilliant, poetic, and emotionally powerful films ever made.
Speaker E.
I never used to like cartoons, but Ratatouille is, in a word, perfect. It's the essence of cinematic. It is beautifully photographed. Amazing, fluid, sailing, flying camera movement, wonderful storytelling, endearing characters, and acting. And it's all about the love of food and finding the artist within yourself, being true to yourself and your abilities and passions. I absolutely adore this film and hope to see it again and again.
Speaker F.
This is one of a handful of movies to earn a 5-star rating from me. Wall-E should be recognised as the first film to truly reconcile digital technology with a human soul. Every single frame reflected back into itself as the artists and engineers created a mechanical character who gleaned the essence of humanity by sifting through all the things we tossed away. In the end, the machine captured the human condition and presented it back to us, using sophisticated and frequently brilliant film references. The movie successfully showed us how our rush toward digitization could destroy the fragile physical world we call home.
You have 15 seconds to complete the task. Now you will hear the texts again. Speaker A.
My absolute favorite film of all time is Local Hero. Peter Riggert plays a Texas oil man who's sent to a stunningly picturesque Scottish fishing town to negotiate with the locals to buy the whole town so that his company can raise it to build an enormous oil refinery. This film, while being warm and hilarious, is also one of the most subtle films I've ever seen. The humor of some of the scenes can slip by if you're not paying attention. In fact, I picked up more and of its subtleties with each subsequent viewing.
Speaker B.
Manhattan is a film that could make a boy like me, who's never been to New York, fall in love with the place. Funny, bittersweet, sad, pulsing to the great tunes of George Gershwin, and shot in stunningly gorgeous widescreen black and white by Gordon Willis. And I almost always cry at the ending. I think this is Woody Allen's greatest film, despite the fact that Annie Hall won more accolades from Hollywood. It's far more sophisticated, more bittersweet, still bitingly funny, but more of a ride for your emotions. A masterpiece.
Speaker C.
Mere words fail to describe this film. You've heard of it. It's A Space Odyssey. See it if you haven't, and prepare to have your mind blown. It is a film that sort of encompasses art as a whole rather than just utilizing the cinema. It is a movie, it is a painting, it is a philosophy book, and finally a musical symphony. Do not watch it on video, or you'll miss two-thirds of the images. Douglas Trumbull and the people who brought Arthur C. Clarke and Stanley Kubrick's vision to the screen set a standard of visual effects that's still hard to beat, in my opinion.
Speaker D.
My favourite film, The Jetty, is in black and white. It's in French, it's only 30 minutes long, and except for one briefly moving image, it's told entirely in still images. After the destruction of Paris in World War III, a man obsessed by an image from his childhood is sent by the rulers of the survivors as an emissary to the past, in search of food and medicine. Precisely because this image seems to be the only thing keeping the journey through time from failing. There, he falls in love. It's one of the most amazing, brilliant, poetic, and emotionally powerful films ever made.
Speaker E.
I never used to like cartoons, but Ratatouille is, in a word, perfect. It's the essence of cinematic. It is beautifully photographed. Amazing, fluid, sailing, flying camera movement, wonderful storytelling, endearing characters, and acting. And it's all about the love of food and finding the artist within yourself, being true to yourself and your abilities and passions. I absolutely adore this film and hope to see it again and again.
Speaker F.
This is one of a handful of movies to earn a 5-star rating from me. Wall-E should be recognized as the first film to truly reconcile digital technology with a human soul. Every single frame reflected back into itself as the artists and engineers created a mechanical character who gleaned the essence of humanity by sifting through all the things we tossed away. In the end, the machine captured the human condition and presented it back to us, using sophisticated and frequently brilliant film references. The movie successfully showed us how our rush toward digitization could destroy the fragile physical world we call home.
This is the end of the task. You now have 15 seconds to check your answers.
Задание 2. Вы услышите диалог. Определите, какие из приведенных утверждений A-G соответствуют содержанию текста. 1. True. Какие не соответствуют? 2. False. И о чем в тексте не сказано? То есть на основании текста нельзя дать ни положительного, ни отрицательного ответа. 3. Not stated. Занесите номер выбранного вами варианта ответа в таблицу. Вы услышите запись дважды. У вас есть 20 секунд, чтобы ознакомиться с заданиями.
Now we are ready to start.
I know you've always been interested in painting, even when you were a young boy. Now, I'm particularly interested in this new project of yours, which is aimed at encouraging the under-16s to paint.
Yeah, I can't imagine life without painting. But you're right. My main passion at the moment is getting through to kids. A few months ago, I was doing a TV show, and at the end of the program, I asked kids to write in and tell me how many of them spent time at home painting.
Did you get many replies?
I was amazed at the response. I thought if I get 100 replies, I'll be pleased. But do you know, I got more than 4,000, and from kids all over the world. They wrote and told me what they paint, whether they use oils, watercolour, crayons, or even make their own special paint mixtures. And in a way, it proved my theory, because I was convinced that there must be loads of young people out there painting, even though most TV art programmes are targeted at adult audiences.
And have you discovered things about this age group that do surprise you?
Yeah, I guess I thought these kids would be painting for their friends, but what's really nice is that they're painting for their families. In most cases, kids put up their pictures on their kitchen walls, stick them on the fridge door or a cup cupboard somewhere, but if everyone really likes it, they'll get a frame and hang it somewhere. It can be admired by all. I think that's great.
I can remember when I was a kid that my mother used to get fed up with me if I spread things all over the kitchen table and then didn't clear away. Do you think this generation is any different?
Probably not, but some kids mentioned a great idea, which is that their parents set aside special times for them to take over the kitchen. One lad said he'd been painting since he was 8 and that he'd learned good practice automatically and now clears away and washes up his brushes without being told.
Is it difficult trying to experiment with mixing your own paints?
Expensive, if not difficult. I used to ask my parents to buy all sorts of different kinds of oil paints so I could try out new ideas. They were pretty good about it, but I know they weren't happy if I wasted the paint or it was such a disgusting colour that it had to be thrown away. They preferred it if I played safe.
So what happens now with all the information you've collected?
The next thing is to select about 20 kids and involve them in my own TV art programme, but using their ideas and pictures. I'm reading through things to see who sounds adventurous and who has really tried to create something individual. It's also important to get a good range of ages into the programme, from about 8 to 16, and obviously a mix of boys and girls.
I thought the advice was to never work with animals or children.
Yeah, I think it is. You'll never see me in an art programme with animals, that's for sure. But what I'd like is to create a relaxed atmosphere where viewers can learn as well as enjoy what's going on. I can imagine we're all going to get in each other's way, but then that's what an artist studio is usually like. My dad would offer to help and just get in the way, messing up my paints and trying out different colours before I'd finished. It was maddening.
Well, thank you for talking to us today and good luck.
You have 15 seconds to complete the task. Now you will hear the text again.
I know you've always been interested in painting, even when you were a young boy. Now, I'm particularly interested in this new project of yours, which is aimed at encouraging the under-16s to paint.
Yeah, I can't imagine life without painting. But you're right. My main passion at the moment is getting through to kids. A few months ago, I was doing a TV show, and at the end of the program, I asked kids to write in and tell me how many of them spent time at home painting.
Did you get many replies?
I was amazed at the response. I thought if I get 100 replies, I'll be pleased. But do you know, I got more than 4,000, and from kids all over the world. They wrote and told me what they paint, whether they use oils, watercolour, crayons, or even make their own special paint mixtures. And in a way, it proved my theory, because I was convinced that there must be loads of young people out there painting, even though most TV art programmes are targeted at adult audiences.
And have you discovered things about this age group that do surprise you?
Yeah, I guess I thought these kids would be painting for their friends, but what's really nice is that they're painting for their families. In most cases, kids put up their pictures on their kitchen walls, stick them on the fridge door or a cup cupboard somewhere, but if everyone really likes it, they'll get a frame and hang it somewhere. It can be admired by all. I think that's great.
I can remember when I was a kid that my mother used to get fed up with me if I spread things all over the kitchen table and then didn't clear away. Do you think this generation is any different?
Probably not, but some kids mentioned a great idea, which is that their parents set aside special times for them to take over the kitchen. One lad said he'd been painting since he was 8 and that he'd learned good practice automatically and now clears away and washes up his brushes without being told.
Is it difficult trying to experiment with mixing your own paints?
Expensive, if not difficult. I used to ask my parents to buy all sorts of different kinds of oil paints so I could try out new ideas. They were pretty good about it, but I know they weren't happy if I wasted the paint, or it was such a disgusting colour that it had to be thrown away. They preferred it if I played safe.
So what happens now with all the information you've collected?
The next thing is to select about 20 kids and involve them in my own TV art programme, but using their ideas and pictures. I'm reading through things to see who sounds adventurous and who has really tried to create something individual. It's also important to get a good range of ages into the programme, from about 8 to 16, and obviously a mix of boys and girls.
I thought the advice was to never work with animals or children.
Yeah, I think it is. You'll never see me in an art programme with animals, that's for sure. But what I'd like is to create a relaxed atmosphere where viewers can learn as well as enjoy what's going on. I can imagine we're all going to get in each other's way, but then that's what an artist studio is usually like. My dad would offer to help and just get in the way, messing up my paints and trying out different colours before I'd finished. It was maddening.
Well, thank you for talking to us today, and good luck.
This is the end of the task. You now have 15 seconds to check your answers.
Задание 3.9. Вы услышите интервью с менеджером по окружающей среде. В заданиях 3.9 запишите в поле ответа цифру 1, 2 или 3, соответствующую выбранному вами варианту ответа. Вы услышите запись дважды. У вас есть 50 секунд, чтобы ознакомиться с заданиями.
Now we are ready to start.
Can you explain the difference between the managed and unmanaged forest before we talk about water quality?
An example of an unmanaged forest might be a national park where, by law, no forest management activities are allowed. They are strictly there to serve as recreation and as just natural areas. That's one extreme. And then you have, say, land that is owned by the forest industry. We own the land to produce timber, to produce raw materials for our mills. When I speak of a managed forest, I'm talking about a place where trees are planted, they're nurtured through their lifetime, and they're thinned. There might be some fertilisation, then ultimately they are harvested, taken to a mill to make forest products, and then the next forest is started.
In your view, what is the role of the forest in producing high-quality water?
In any given river basin, the best water quality comes from the forest. This is true whether it's a national park, where basically nothing is going on, or whether it's a very heavily managed forest. If you think about a forest, when it rains, some of the rain is intercepted by the tops of the trees and held there. The velocity of the rain is reduced as it falls down through the forest canopy, so that when the rain actually strikes the forest floor, it's striking it with much less force. Plus, the forest floor is covered with leaves and bushes and other vegetation that also helps to absorb the velocity of the water as it falls. Therefore, you don't get the rapid surface water runoff from the rainfall that you might get in some other land use, worst case being pavement. In addition to that, the trees have deep root systems, which create opportunities for lots of underground water storage. The water will eventually seep its way through the soil into the streams, rather than running across the surface and perhaps picking up sediment and other pollutants that can get into the water. That's it in a nutshell. That's what the forest does for water quality.
What advice would you give to developers or city planners about the importance of trees?
I think trees are important in cities for a number of reasons. First of all, they make for a more attractive place. Additionally, trees mitigate, to some degree, hot temperatures and provide shade. Trees, especially in a hot climate, can make it more comfortable. As we all know, trees take in carbon dioxide and give off oxygen, and that's something that we all need. And certainly the more trees you have scattered out through developed areas, the more places you have for songbirds and squirrels and other types of wildlife.
When the drought occurred last summer, we had a state of emergency. As an environmental manager, what is your view of what was happening and what may mean from a larger perspective?
We've always had droughts, and certainly the drought of last year was an extremely difficult one. Just looking at it from a forestry standpoint, you have to worry about whether the trees are getting enough water, and certainly the trees that had recently been planted just the winter before. That year is a critical year, and they need enough water in their first year.
So you really do get worried about it, because it could destroy the forest ultimately, if there wasn't enough water, especially for the new crops?
A drought could probably not destroy the forest, but it certainly does slow down its growth. If trees are stressed by drought, it makes them more susceptible to disease and to attack by insects. As I mentioned, the trees that have just recently been planted are particularly susceptible to drought in that first year.
Speaking about saltwater intrusion, how do you see the problem getting started in the first place?
The salt water moving up the river is largely a result of not enough fresh water coming down the river to keep the salt water out where it's supposed to be. This holds true particularly in times of drought. It allows the salt water to come farther and farther up the river.
What are the reasons why the water is reduced downstream?
The fresh water flow can be reduced for a number of reasons. One is natural drought, which we can't do a whole lot about. Another is interbasin transfer. Say, if someone in one river basin is pulling their drinking water out of a particular river, using it, treating it, and then discharging it into a different river, then certainly there's been a net loss of fresh water flow coming down the river where that water was drawn. Consumptive uses can also affect the volume of fresh water. I mean uses where water is taken out of the river for manufacturing practices and released as steam, as opposed to being treated and released back into the river. Certainly as population increases, people need more water for drinking and washing clothes, and more water is drawn out of the river.
Many industries use water, and fresh water is key to the economy of areas. What happened last year to your company when salt was making its way up the river? What would the salt have done if it had gotten into your operations?
If the salt water comes far enough up the river and gets into the water intake where our manufacturing facility takes in the water, we cannot use salt water in the process that we use to make pulp and paper. That results in having to shut the operations down, and that entails great costs. Plus, it sends employees home. It puts us in a position where we are no longer able to accept logs from loggers, so it affects the loggers that are out in the countryside.
How concerned are you about the future of saltwater intrusion, as upriver as you are?
We've always experienced saltwater intrusion in these coastal rivers. It is a natural phenomenon. However, more water will be drawn out of the river upstream as the population increases, or if you have more situations of interbasin transfer. We don't have a lot of that going on right now, but should that increase in the future, then the obvious result would be more frequent occurrences of salt water coming up the river, and that does give us concern. The intrusion of salt water in these freshwater rivers not only has an impact, say, on manufacturing, but also has an impact on the biological communities that are in these rivers. I'm not an expert in that, but I think I know enough to predict that when the water becomes saltier, the dissolved oxygen content will decrease, and in most cases, less dissolved oxygen is not good for many of the fish and plant communities that are in these river systems.
You have 15 seconds to complete the task. Now, you will hear the text again.
Can you explain the difference between the managed and unmanaged forest before we talk about water quality?
An example of an unmanaged forest might be a national park where, by law, no forest management activities are allowed. They are strictly there to serve as recreation and as just natural areas. That's one extreme. And then you have, say, land that is owned by the forest industry. We own the land to produce timber, to produce raw materials for our mills. When I speak of a managed forest, I'm talking about a place where trees are planted, they are nurtured through their lifetime, and they're thinned. There might be some fertilization, then ultimately they are harvested, taken to a mill to make forest products, and then the next forest is started.
In your view, what is the role of the forest in producing high-quality water?
In any given river basin, the best water quality comes from the forest. This is true whether it's a national park, where basically nothing is going on, or whether it's a very heavily managed forest. If you think about a forest, when it rains, some of the rain is intercepted by the tops of the trees and held there. The velocity of the rain is reduced as it falls down through the forest canopy so that when the rain actually strikes the forest floor, it's striking it with much less force. Plus, the forest floor is covered with leaves and bushes and other vegetation that also helps to absorb the velocity of the water as it falls. Therefore, you don't get the rapid surface water runoff from the rainfall that you might get in some other land use, worst case being pavement. In addition to that, the trees have deep root systems, which create opportunities for lots of underground water storage. The water will eventually seep its way through the soil into the streams, rather than running across the surface and perhaps picking up sediment and other pollutants that can get into the water. That's it in a nutshell. That's what the forest does for water quality.
What advice would you give to developers or city planners about the importance of trees?
I think trees are important in cities for a number of reasons. First of all, they make for a more attractive place. Additionally, trees mitigate, to some degree, hot temperatures and provide shade. Trees, especially in a hot climate, can make it more comfortable. As we all know, trees take in carbon dioxide and give off oxygen, and that's something that we all need. And certainly the more trees you have scattered out through developed areas, the more places you have for songbirds and squirrels and other types of wildlife.
When the drought occurred last summer, we had a state of emergency. As an environmental manager, what is your view of what was happening and what may mean from a larger perspective?
We've always had droughts, and certainly the drought of last year was an extremely difficult one. Just looking at it from a forestry standpoint, you have to worry about whether the trees are getting enough water, and certainly the trees that had recently been planted just the winter before. That year is a critical year, and they need enough water in their first year.
So you really do get worried about it, because it could destroy the forest ultimately, if there wasn't enough water, especially for the new crops?
A drought could probably not destroy the forest, but it certainly does slow down its growth. If trees are stressed by drought, it makes them more susceptible to disease and to attack by insects. As I mentioned, the trees that have just recently been planted are particularly susceptible to drought in that first year.
Speaking about saltwater intrusion, how do you see the problem getting started in the first place?
The saltwater moving up the river is largely a result of not enough fresh water coming down the river to keep the saltwater out where it's supposed to be. This holds true particularly in times of drought. It allows the salt water to come farther and farther up the river.
What are the reasons why the water is reduced downstream?
The freshwater flow can be reduced for a number of reasons. One is natural drought, which we can't do a whole lot about. Another is interbasin transfer. Say, if someone in one river basin is pulling their drinking water out of a particular river, using it, treating it, and then discharging it into a different river, then certainly there's been a net loss of fresh water flow coming down the river where that water was drawn. Consumptive uses can also affect the volume of fresh water. I mean uses where water is taken out of the river for manufacturing practices and released as steam, as opposed to being treated and released back into the river. Certainly as population increases, people need more water for drinking and washing clothes, and more water is drawn out of the river.
Many industries use water, and fresh water is key to the economy of areas. What happened last year to your company when salt was making its way up the river? What would the salt have done if it had gotten into your operations?
If the salt water comes far enough up the river and gets into the water intake where our manufacturing facility takes in the water, we cannot use salt water in the process that we use to make pulp and paper. That results in having to shut the operations down, and that entails great costs. Plus, it sends employees home. It puts us in a position where we are no longer able to accept logs from loggers, so it affects the loggers that are out in the countryside.
How concerned are you about the future of saltwater intrusion, as upriver as you are?
We've always experienced saltwater intrusion in these coastal rivers. It is a natural phenomenon. However, more water will be drawn out of the river upstream as the population increases, or if you have more situations of interbasin transfer. We don't have a lot of that going on right now, but should that increase in the future, then the obvious result would be more frequent occurrences of salt water coming up the river, and that does give us concern. The intrusion of salt water in these freshwater rivers not only has an impact, say, on manufacturing, but also has an impact on the biological communities that are in these rivers. I'm not an expert in that, but I think I know enough to predict that when the water becomes saltier, the dissolved oxygen content will decrease, and in most cases, less dissolved oxygen is not good for many of the fish and plant communities that are in these river systems.
This is the end of the task. You now have 15 seconds to check your answers. This is the end of the listening test.
Время, отведенное на выполнение заданий, истекло.